You're listening to Program to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica with your host, Jimmy Falun Gong. This is Premium Episode 10, Novels as Spycraft Part 2, Pedophiles, Carol, Barry, and H.G. Wells' New World Order. Today I'm recording from Christ Church at Oxford. By the way, this episode deals with child abuse. I am not particularly explicit, but just a heads up for a content warning. And if this stuff depresses you or, you know, anything like that, don't mess around with it. If you don't think you can handle something, it's okay to take a break or listen to it down the road. That said, I don't think this episode is super dark. So, you know, just fair warning, okay? Take care of yourself, dear listener. Let's get right into the question today. I'm returning to Telishism's question from before, wherein they asked, after listening to Esoteric Nazism and in reference to novels as spycraft, any plans to do, you know, a show about the use of novels, and so on and so on. And I've done one episode so far. I think it was premium episode 8, right? And in that episode, I talked about several categories of novels as spycraft, and the first category covered in that episode was novels intentionally or unintentionally disclosing spy history or narratives, whether written by spies or not. The second category that we'll talk about today is the idea that there are certain novels used to seed the public with certain esoteric ideas, whether written by spies or not. Now, this can be a very broad field, arguably the broadest, since it's normal for any type of author to instill a worldview or try to instill opinions on its readers, right? Like, that's just normal. But what I'm talking about are novels which include a predictive or magical or theosophical concepts, and which are particularly notable or recur for some reason. I think it'll make more sense if we go into some. So right off the bat, there's two that we've already talked about on the show. There's The Wizard of Oz by L. Frank Baum, which I talked about before, I believe, in Premium Episode 2. That's the episode where I talked about the coin shortage, and then we talked about the free silver movement and all of the weird aspects to The Wizard of Oz novel, right? There's also the case of Ernst Weiss, who we talked about in Episode 4, which was when he obtained Hitler's medical file and wrote a novel called The Eyewitness, describing Hitler's hypnosis. Now, I personally believe that this hypnosis more or less happened, but true or not, the point of the novel was to undermine Hitler and the Nazis. The fact that I happened to find that admirable is, aside from the point that it was a novel used to seed the public with ideas that, you know, Nazis are bad. So it falls in this category too, right? But let's talk about more novels in grayer territory, right? Let's get into it. So there's the nonce Lewis Carroll, who wrote Alice in Wonderland, and of course a bunch of other books. Alice in Wonderland is a very peculiar work. I'm still sorting out my thoughts about Lewis Carroll, because I think it goes even deeper than what I have managed to put together. But let's look at some basic facts. Lewis Carroll came from a family of high church Anglicans, including lots of clergy in his family. Lewis Carroll, as a young adult, he plugged into the pre-Raphaelite movement. He attended Christ Church College in Oxford. Then he basically stayed there, teaching mathematics. I find it interesting that he was one of the first members of the Society for Psychical Research. In his letters, he also talks about a belief in mind reading, which he called thought reading. Now, while he was at Christ Church teaching, Lewis Carroll became close to the dean, Henry Liddell, and his family, especially his three young daughters, Lorena, Edith, and Alice Liddell. It has long been speculated that the character Alice is based on these daughters, particularly Alice. And there's so much evidence for this being the case that it's not really worth litigating. It's pretty clear. Lewis Carroll would often take these girls on rowing trips. Biographers are sure to assure us that these rowing trips were chaperoned, but if you think about it, it's weird to insist or need a chaperone in the first place. Anyway, I'll just keep moving. Head down, we gotta get through some facts here. Lewis Carroll was an avid sketch artist. His favorite subject to draw was young girls, and of course, that included drawing young nude girls. Separate from that, Lewis Carroll was an avid photographer. He was a photography enthusiast, right? Yet again, his favorite subjects to photograph were girls. Young girls, often nude. Fully half of Lewis Carroll's existing prints depict young girls as a subject. Now, some people have pointed out that we have only about 40% of his original collection. 60% of his original collection went missing. And I have not been able to figure out where the rest of his collection went. The way they frame it, there's 60% missing, presumably not of young girls, therefore he's probably not a nonce. But you could read these facts in the exact opposite light and say, for some reason 60% of this guy's photographs went missing, and it shows an obsession with young girls. You could read these facts in a different light than trying to exonerate him, right? Now here's another chilling phrase for you. Lewis Carroll found photography to be a useful entry into higher social circles. Oh, I'm sure he did. I would like to read you a passage from Lewis Carroll's biographer, Professor Morton Norton Cohen. Morton Norton Cohen. He said, Carroll's sexual energies sought unconventional outlets. We cannot know to what extent sexual urges lay behind Charles's preference for drawing and photographing children in the nude. He contended that the preference was entirely aesthetic, but given his emotional attachment to children as well as his aesthetic appreciation of their forms, his assertion that his interest was strictly artistic is naive. He probably felt more than he dared to acknowledge, even to himself. Unquote. Which I would say this is something of a whitewash, because he's conceding that Lewis Carroll was somewhat naive to his own proclivities, but then he also says, we cannot know to what extent sexual urges lay behind his preference for drawing and photographing children in the nude. Like, come on, dude. Morton Norton Cohen. Morton Norton Cohen points out for proof that Lewis Carroll convinced many of his friends and acquaintances that there was no problem with these photographs and behaviors. As if, you know, that should be some sort of proof, right? Morton Norton Cohen also talks about when Lewis Carroll proposed to marry Alice Liddell. She was only 11 at the time. And he says that this caused a break with the Liddell family in 1863. However, in the New York Times, they wrote, and I quote, Lewis Carroll exhibited a lifelong affection for little girls, seeking them out not only to enjoy their company and to tell them stories, but also to photograph them, at times naked. His university colleagues thought this bizarre, unquote. So no, Morton Norton Cohen, this was not considered particularly normal, even in Victorian England. The New York Times also talked about Lewis Carroll's break with the Liddell family, which they described as something closer to him being banned from the home, not a break with the family. I also want to take note here. 1863, he's basically banned from seeing the Liddell children by the dean. In 1864, he gives Alice Liddell a handwritten manuscript of Alice's adventures underground, and he dedicates it as a Christmas gift to a dear child in memory of a summer's day. Then, in 1865, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland is published. Now, this is like insane person behavior, writing a whole elaborate book about a young girl's trippy psychedelic adventures, and he gives it to a girl that he's banned from seeing for his unhealthy interest in them, right? Now, this next fact is disputed, but the Encyclopedia Britannica still says it, so, you know, judge for yourself. the Encyclopedia Britannica reports that Lewis Carroll generally lost interest in his child friends after they reached the age of 12. Like, come on, folks, he's definitely a pedophile. Professor Catherine Robson referred to Lewis Carroll as the Victorian era's most famous or infamous girl lover. There's a cottage industry of academics trying to protect him. I would say exonerate, but exonerate implies that he was found guilty at any point, which is not exactly the case. The academics use a host of tactics, the biggest one saying it was a different time. Victorian conceptions of nudity were different, and eroticism itself was just, it was different. It's a mistake to view his child photography with 20th or 21st century eyes, and to present it as some form of personal idiosyncrasy when he's just an aesthete. He was just responding to the aesthetic and philosophical movements of the time. But, like, people aren't that different. It's not like pedophiles were invented in the 20th or the 21st century. Like, come on, folks. Now, you know me, dear listener. I might have Epstein brain, but I am not particularly obsessed with hunting down pedophiles in every sphere of society. Like, I'm not particularly more interested in pedophiles than any other type of criminal. But I am curious to know why Lewis Carroll is and always has been a beloved children's author. I find that very curious. The book Programmed to Kill documents the existence of a quarterly publication called the Lewis Carroll Collectors Guild, which described itself as a voluntary association of persons who believe nudist materials are constitutionally protected expression and whose collective interests include preteen nudes. Which, I mean, yes, I would say that appears to be entirely in the spirit of Lewis Carroll. Along the same lines, in 1998, an international investigation uncovered a large pedophile network called Wonderland. Police in 13 countries and across 22 U.S. states made raids and arrested around 200 people. And what to make of the novel Alice in Wonderland? Much like The Wizard of Oz, there is a lot going on. On the surface, beneath. On the surface, it's a children's book, obviously. It's also, pretty transparently, a satire of mathematics. Others, however, have described it as a Freudian descent into the dark world of the subconscious, which, you know, is a normal thing to give to a child that you propose marriage to at age 11, right? In the more wingnut Project Monarch literature about mind control, Alice in Wonderland features prominently. And that would be easy to dismiss if all of the things we just talked about were not documented facts, right? Anyway, let's move on. Flashing lights and we took a wrong turn and we fell down a rabbit hole. You held on tight to me, 'cause nothing's as it seems, and spinning out of control. Didn't they tell us to rush in the things? Didn't you flash your green eyes at me? Haven't you heard what becomes of curious minds?
Strangers watching and whispers turned to talking and talking. treasure cat smile. Ooh, didn't it all seem new and exciting? I felt your arms twisting around me. It's all fun and games till somebody loses their mind. But darling, we found Wonderland. You and I got lost in it, and we pretended it could last forever. We found Wonderland. You and I got lost in it. Was never worse, but never better.
Let's talk about J.M. Barrie, the author of Peter Pan. J.M. Barrie came from another strongly religious family, this time conservative Calvinist, and he seems to have had a pretty psychologically gothic childhood. Like, there's stuff that I'm skipping over, but one thing in particular, his mother dressed him up in his dead brother's clothes and pretended that he was his brother. Which I'm sure, you know, is not particularly fun for him as a child. There's a host of other weird things. Barrie was from a middle-class family in Scotland, so he didn't attend Oxford. He was not really in the same social class as Lewis Carroll. He was much more middle-class. Barrie was friends with many British authors, however, including George Bernard Shaw and H.G. Wells. Here's a curious anecdote. J.M. Barrie, at one point, visited the children of the Duke of York when they were young. He was visiting with the future Queen Elizabeth II and Princess Margaret. After meeting him, the 3-year-old Princess Margaret announced, "He is my greatest friend, and I am his greatest friend." By all accounts, he did seem to get along very well with children. So, J.M. Barrie married an actress in 1891. It has been reported that the marriage was unconsummated, and of course they had no children. Now, Barrie happened to become close to Arthur and Sylvia Ewan Davies, and especially to their 5 young children, and I mean very close. In fact, he invented the Peter Pan stories to entertain these children. He became even more involved in their lives when the father of the family, Arthur, died in 1907. Here's where things really start to take a creepy turn. In 1910, Sylvia Ewan Davies died as well. Following her death, J.M. Barrie claimed that they had been engaged to be married. But if that were true, literally none of Sylvia's friends or family knew about it. In Sylvia's first will, she had several, she wrote that she wanted Barrie to be a trustee and guardian to their children, along with her mother, her brother, and her husband's brother. In the wake of these 5 children's parents dying, J.M. Barrie moved in to live at the Ewan Davies family home. The family was in a bind because Sylvia wrote in her will that she wanted to keep the children together, while only Barrie had the time and the money to do that. Otherwise, the children would have had to have been divvied up amongst different relatives. Now, several months after Sylvia's death, J.M. Barrie happened to find a second will that she wrote. He then transcribed it by hand and sent the handwritten copy to Sylvia's mother, who was the co-trustee to the Ewan Davies children. In the transcribed copy, it reads, "What I would like would be if Jimmy would come to Mary and that the two together would be looking after the boys and the house and helping each other, and it would be so nice for Mary." The original will, however, does not read as Jimmy, as in Jimmy Barrie. It reads Jenny, as in Jenny Hodgson, which is to say the sister of the children's nurse. It was not Sylvia's intention for Barrie to live with their children, right? So one of Barrie's biographers, Andrew Birkin, he wrote the book J.M. Barrie and the Lost Boys. He said, "The mistranscription was no doubt unintentional, although the word Jenny is clear enough," unquote. But the timing of the second will and the mistranscription, it raises some questions, wouldn't you say? However, Birkin writes, "Any lingering objections to Barrie's official adoption of the five children were overruled when he produced Sylvia's second will, confirming Jimmy's right to look after the boys with Mary." Now, I know what you're thinking. What did the Ewan Davies children have to say about Barrie and his relationship to them? The youngest child, Nico Ewan Davies, he wrote, "I don't believe that Uncle Jim ever experienced what one might call a stirring in the undergrowth for anyone, man, woman, or child." Separately, when writing to Birkin, Nico Ewan Davies wrote, "I'm 200% certain that there was never a desire to kiss other than on the cheek, though things obviously went through his mind, often producing magic, which never go through the more ordinary minds of such as myself. All I can say for certain is that I never heard one word or saw one glimmer of anything approaching homosexuality or pedophilia. He had neither of these leanings. In however slight a symptom, I would have been aware. He was an innocent, which is why he could write Peter Pan." Now that sounds like an ironclad defense, right? Except for the bit where he writes, "though things obviously went through his mind, often producing magic, which never goes through the more ordinary minds of such as myself." I'm not sure what that's supposed to mean. Like, he's asexual except in his mind, but that creates magic? To me, that just sounds like he's a nonce, right? Now, everyone is quick to point out that there is no evidence that Barrie ever had sexual contact with children, nor that he was suspected of it at the time. But there are curious elements of it in his stories, like you might imagine. There's a scene in the novel The Little White Bird, in which the adult protagonist helps a child undress for bed, and at the boy's request, they sleep in the same bed. Along the same lines, Nico would not have been the child Barrie was most interested in. That would have been George or Michael. What did they have to say about it? We don't know, because in 1915, George died in combat in World War I, but Michael drowned, either in an accident or a suicide, take your pick. He drowned in a lock near Oxford in 1921. Peter Ewan Davies, one of the other children, jumped in front of a train and killed himself in 1960. To return to the topic of Barrie's marriage, his wife had an affair in 1908. He divorced her for infidelity. After his remarriage, Barrie continued to support Mary financially, even after she married the man that she, you know, was cheating on Barrie with. Barrie continued to give her an annual allowance, which was handed over at a private dinner on their wedding anniversary. What does that sound like to you? Now, when I read about J.M. Barrie, it sounds a whole lot like Michael Jackson, right? And a lot of people know that Michael Jackson had the Neverland Ranch. A lot of people console themselves with Michael Jackson's weird behavior by thinking, you know, that he was relatively asexual or something. But I don't think it's that controversial to say I'm pretty sure he molested children. Michael Jackson, that is. Now, I'm not going to die on the hill that Barrie molested any of the Ewan Davies children, and they did have a pretty sad childhood with both of their parents dying. But it is interesting that at least one, probably two of the five children committed suicide. Also, did I mention Kenneth Anger, the pagan filmmaker, who is by no means a trustworthy source himself, says in his book Hollywood Babylon 2, quote, "Some animators stated that the boss, Walt Disney, seemed to have fallen in love with the boy. There may be some truth in this," unquote. The boy in this passage, who Walt Disney supposedly fell in love with, was Bobby Driscoll, who was in a bunch of Disney stuff, including The Song of the South, Treasure Island, and, most notably, he was the voice of Peter Pan. Bobby Driscoll went on to become addicted to methamphetamines when he was 17, and he died of a drug overdose several years later, which kind of makes me think of the Ewan Davies children. Then there's the case of H.G. Wells, who, if we'll note, he was taught by Thomas Henry Huxley, Aldous Huxley's grandfather, and H.G. Wells was also friends with J.M. Barrie. H.G. Wells' work prefigured or predicted all kinds of things, like planes, tanks, space travel, nukes, satellites, satellite TV, invisibility cloaks, bioengineering, even arguably the internet. And of course, he predicted stuff that doesn't yet exist, like time travel and aliens, right? Curiously, H.G. Wells wrote a novel in 1914 called The World Set Free. This novel predicted, and I quote, "the liberation of atomic energy on a large scale for industrial purposes, the development of atomic bombs, and a world war which was apparently fought by an alliance of England, France, and America against Germany and Austria," and so on. H.G. Wells also wrote a very interesting pamphlet called The Open Conspiracy. The Open Conspiracy was to be a public collusion of science-minded industrialists and financiers to establish a world republic. That is precisely what Fabian socialism is all about. This is interesting because there are major pushes to head in that direction.
We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order.
It's also interesting because atomic power was developed pretty much in collusion and conspiracy between science-minded industrialists and financiers. People have argued, rightfully, that the concept of an open conspiracy as formulated by H.G. Wells is undemocratic and elitist. One of H.G. Wells' biographers argued that the book is a boost for civil society realized today by bodies such as Greenpeace and Amnesty International, which I would suppose I would agree that the open conspiracy is being advanced by NGOs like Greenpeace and Amnesty International, though I would not agree that it's an unmitigated boost for civil society. Now, the thing about the Fabian Society is that its founding members were Sidney and Beatrice Webb and George Bernard Shaw, along with Annie Besant, H.G. Wells, Bertrand Russell, Arthur Balfour, and Halford Mackinder. The name, Fabian, was in honor of the Roman general Fabius Maximus, who was famous for beating Hannibal by never engaging in direct combat, instead beating him through endurance and attrition. Here's a quote from the founding document of the Fabian Society. "For the right moment you must wait, as Fabius did most patiently when warring against Hannibal, though many censured his delays. But when the time comes, you must strike hard, as Fabius did, or you will be waiting in vain and fruitless." The Fabian Society's original logo, or, you know, symbol, was a wolf in sheep's clothing, which, you know, is the most insane thing I've ever heard, right? Incidentally, it is very hard to discern the difference between democratic socialism and Fabian socialism. On the face of it, their positions are pretty much identical, which, you know, should maybe be disconcerting, right? Now, H.G. Wells wrote this other nonfiction work called The New World Order. It was published by a British publisher, Secker and Warburg. You might remember the Warburg family. I mentioned them briefly in Premium Episode 8. The Warburg family owned Sandoz Laboratories, where LSD was invented. One of the Warburgs was with Alan Dulles in Switzerland at the time. And of course, the Warburgs have been involved in so many things, right? It would be a great episode, or series, in fact, to go through everything the Warburg family has ever done. So anyway, H.G. Wells publishes a piece called The New World Order, published by a publishing house owned by the Warburg family. This book proposed a framework of international functionalism that could guide the world towards achieving world peace. To achieve these ends, H.G. Wells asserted that a socialist and scientifically planned world government would need to be formed to defend human rights. Now, on the face of it, this doesn't sound too bad, or parts of it don't, except that H.G. Wells had close ties to the people who caused, and I mean literally personally caused, the Indian and Irish famines, They are the people who funded Adolf Hitler. They are the families who carried out the opium wars in prior generations and who colonized the world. So I have some major concerns about their plans to give me healthcare. Plus, I don't even have that free healthcare yet, so, you know. So, let's talk about Lewis Carroll and J.M. Barrie.
Please have a seat right there. Come on in over here. Have a seat there. Yeah, have a seat back over there for me.
Mark, please have a seat right here.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, Lewis.
Good. Why don't you have a seat right over there, please?
Sure.
Why don't you have a seat?
There's strawberries and whipped cream and chocolates and stuffed animals. Oh, you got it all going on, don't you?
Oh, wow.
Why don't you have a seat right over there, please? No hug tonight. Okay. Why don't you have a seat right over there, please? Looks like you brought enough stuff to move in.
Yes.
Why don't you have a seat there?
Please have a seat.
Why don't you have a seat right over there for me, please?
I realize I'm not breaking new ground here. A lot of people, like, I've vaguely known that Lewis Carroll and J.M. Barrie were nonces for years. I'm certain that a lot of you did too, especially probably my British listeners, which I do have British listeners. You know, hello to all of my listeners in every country. I talk a lot of shit on Britain, but, you know, it goes without saying I don't hate the average British person. To my original point, a lot of people know about this, but they might not know the specifics of Lewis Carroll and J.M. Barrie. What gets me about Lewis Carroll is that he came from such a strong religious background. He was interested in psychic research. His child photography, basically child porn, was useful in entering higher social circles. I find it disturbing that many of his biographers deny or minimize his proclivities, and also basically make things up to protect him. All of these things disturb me, especially when he's written one of the most famous books for children. For J.M. Barrie, what really blows me away is the whole forged will aspect. Like, it literally sounds like a series of unfortunate events, but like, worse and realistic. Or it also sounds kind of like the novel Lolita, where Humbert weasels his way into a single mother's family in order to abuse her child. Or, you know, the countless, terribly depressing, real-world examples of that exact dynamic happening prior to or during child abuse. And of course, there's the real possibility that one to two of the Ewan Davies children committed suicide later in life. All I'm saying is that we're two for two now with British children's book authors who are pedophiles. It seems like to be a beloved British children's author, you need to be either a spy or a pedophile or both. Now, I'm not trying to cause a moral panic here. Like, I watched the Disney Peter Pan when I was little. It didn't really make an impact on me. Same with the Alice in Wonderland movie. I will say I always thought that Alice in Wonderland was creepy. I didn't really care about Peter Pan. At some point, I read Alice in Wonderland, the book, and I will also still maintain that it's a fucking creepy book. I'm sorry if you like it. I don't care if people read it. That's fine. Listen, I'm not gonna say burning books is cool. I did ironically burn Fahrenheit 451 when I was in high school as a bit. It was pretty funny at the time. But burning books is not what Program to Chill is about. I love books. But I think it's fair to ask why Lewis Carroll and J.M. Barrie's novels are so popular. Is this predictive programming? Or is this just diseased culture pushing diseased novels? Is it a chicken or an egg situation? It's a fair question, and I would argue that it is probably both. Then, switching gears, H.G. Wells was both prophetic about technology, and he wanted an open conspiracy of science-minded industrialists and financiers to create a new world order, led by the British, naturally. H.G. Wells was a Fabian socialist, and Fabian socialism is not oppositional, at the end of the day, to British imperialism. This was made all the more obvious by his relationship to everyone we've mentioned, and his close personal friendship to Winston Churchill. Here, too, H.G. Wells, the Shakespeare of science fiction, has shown himself to be an elitist British chauvinist, and I would argue that it's even embedded in the structure of his work. Like, you could take this pretty far, but the one that obviously comes to mind is the logic of colonization in his War of the Worlds. Either way, it doesn't mean we can't or shouldn't enjoy science fiction as a genre. Incidentally, I don't, but that's more about taste than anything. But it makes sense why so much science fiction seems to be poisoned from the well, when the well was created by stuff like H.G. Wells. I love detective and crime novels. They would absolutely wither under this type of analysis too, right? Like, I'm sure that a lot of the authors are sus. I mean, literally, Dashiell Hammett was a Pinkerton, for God's sake. Like, he was not explicitly reformed either. Like, I'm not casting aspersions to children's or science fiction genres just because I don't particularly like them. All I'm trying to point out is that British novels really do seem to colonize our brains, creating a cartography of the mind. And we should think long and hard about what our values actually are, and whether these books are in keeping with them. Good Lord, that's the most old person sounding moralizing thing I've ever said in my entire life, but whatever. At a minimum, I guess now I've provided you with some anecdotes about some novelists, right? But I will close out by quoting the Church Committee, which was the Senate's investigation into the CIA in 1977. The Church Committee quotes the chief of the CIA's covert action staff, in charge of the covert propaganda program. Quote, "Books differ from all other propaganda media primarily because one single book can significantly change the reader's attitude and action to an extent unmatched by the impact of any other single medium. This is, of course, not true of all books at all times and with all readers, but it is true significantly enough to make books the most important weapon of strategic long-range propaganda." Unquote. The CIA said this. They funded thousands and thousands of books during the Cold War. They took over and created tons of publishers. They almost certainly did not stop after the Cold War. And I'm quoting the CIA because we just don't have the documentation, or at least I'm ignorant of it, for the British. But if books are the most important weapon of strategic long-range propaganda, then I would say that the British are winning by a gigantic margin. And whatever conclusions that you would like to draw from that, whether it be LaRouchean, right-wing, anti-imperialist, or anti-capitalist, you know, draw your conclusions. I'm not going to tell you how to interpret these facts. For sources today, I used several New York Times articles on Lewis Carroll. I used the Encyclopedia Britannica, Programmed to Kill, The Politics of Serial Murder by Dave McGowan. I used the book J.M. Barrie and the Lost Boys by Andrew Birkin. I used Hollywood Babylon 2 by Kenneth Anger. And of course, the Senate's Church Committee from 1977. Thanks for listening, dear listener. You're on the Patreon, of course, so just tell people about the show. I appreciate your support. See you next episode, and God bless.
Midnight on the 12th of August, a huge mass of luminous gas erupted from Mars and sped towards Earth. Across 200 million miles of void, invisibly hurtling towards us, came the first of the missiles that were to bring so much calamity to Earth. As I watched, there was another jet of gas. It was another missile, starting on its way. Spurting out from Mars, bright green, drawing a green mist behind it, a beautiful but somehow disturbing sight. Ogilvy, the astronomer, assured me we were in no danger. He was convinced there could be no living thing on that remote, forbidding planet.
The chances of anything coming from Mars are a million to one, he said. Of anything coming from Mars are a million to one, but still they come.
Then came the night the first missile approached Earth. It was thought to be an ordinary falling star, but next day there was a huge crater in the middle of the common, and Ogilvy came to examine what lay there. A cylinder, 30 yards across, glowing hot, and with faint sounds of movement coming from within. Suddenly the top began moving, rotating, unscrewing. And Ogilvy feared there was a man inside trying to escape. He rushed to the cylinder, but the intense heat stopped him before he could burn himself on the metal.
The chances of anything coming from Mars are a million to one, he said. The chances of anything coming from Mars are a million to one. He said, the chances of anything coming from Mars are a million to one, but still they come.
It seems totally incredible to me now that everyone spent that evening as though it were just like any other. From the railway station came the sound of shunting trains, ringing and rumbling, softened almost into melody by the distance. It all seemed so safe and tranquil.